The White House has released its 2015 national security strategy. It highlights America's recovery from the financial crisis of 2008 and the importance of leading in a challenged world. It also focuses on how the Defense Department will execute the rebalance to Asia and the Middle East. For more analysis, as well as what separates this version from the 2010 version, we turn to Jacob Stokes. He's a fellow at the Center for a New American Security. Jake, good morning. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
All right. Reading through this, I see a lot of nice statements about American leadership and prosperity and getting rid of nuclear weapons. Where do you think the meat is in this particular document?
Well, a lot of people have talked about this document as being about strategic patience, which is a term the president uses in his intro letter. But I actually think the document is it more fits in a description that might be sustainment, right? The sort of the description of building strength and remaining firm in the face of challenges. So any particular national security strategy is not about necessarily a to-do list. So in that way, it's going to be sort of light on meat, but it's really about articulating the president's worldview and the administration's worldview. And so when you look at the broader kind of set of challenges, I think that sustainment idea is really what you're looking at here.
And so it seems like a component of sustainment is the reluctance to use ground troops. I mean, because if you look at what's going on with ISIS, for example, would that be a manifestation of this policy in action?
I think when you look at the risk management approach that's embodied here, it's not a reluctance to use ground troops, but rather a reluctance to use ground troops for risks that aren't necessarily best combated with ground troops. In other words, the risk from ISIS is not necessarily best met by sending in 100,000 troops, as the experience in Iraq and Afghanistan, I think, has shown many folks.
All right. And what about the Ukraine and that whole deal going on now? I mean, the report or the strategy does cite the sanctions that have been imposed by United States leadership and probably having some effect on Russia, you know, as a nation.
Sure.
So how does that square with the strategy? Is that another example?
Yeah, I think if you look at the language that's used towards Russia, especially when you compare it, for example, to the language that's used even towards China, the language towards Russia is very harsh, very direct, and it talks about reassuring allies and standing up to Russian aggression. You know, Ukraine is not an ally. Ukraine is not part of NATO. But even there, even within NATO, the administration has really looked to reinforce true presence in Eastern Europe and contain the European Reassurance Initiative, which is about a $1 billion fund to reassure partners there. So it's not about necessarily moving with the military option first, but it is standing up for these big international order questions, of which Russian aggression towards Ukraine counts as one.
Yeah, it's true that Ukraine is not in NATO. I was reading a story just this morning, actually, that the nation of Poland has put aside billions and billions, you know, it's not that big an economy, to upgrade its military forces over the next 10 years, because they're worried that what could happen in Ukraine could then happen in Europe. And, of course, Poland is a NATO member. And so does this strategy address what might happen and how the United States would respond should a NATO country be probed in this manner by Russia?
Sure. It talks about an unequivocal commitment to defend allies, which I think in particular in the case of NATO, right, Europe being our closest allies in the world and in a number of senses, there really should be no doubt in the Russians' mind about what the NATO response should be. I think the question is about Ukraine is a different one because it looks at how you can best assure Ukrainian independence, but also how Ukraine can serve as sort of a buffer between NATO states and Russia. And there's a big debate about that, but the strategy is unequivocal about defending allies.
Of course, Ukraine, you know, was talking about joining the European Union, but I don't think there was any talk about it joining NATO, correct?
I mean, there has been over the years. I mean, before this started, the Ukrainian public opinion about joining NATO was very low. Basically, more or less, the Ukrainian public wasn't interested in doing it because I think probably for large reasons because they thought it might provoke Russian aggression. But as we've seen, that's happened anyway.
All right. We're speaking with Jacob Stokes. He's a fellow at the Center for a New American Security. And I want to turn to the defense budget that the president has proposed for 2016. And it's somewhat more than would have been allowed under sequestration and the Budget Control Act. does what you see in that budget and some of the priorities and plus-ups that would happen there, is that all in line with what is stated in the national security strategy?
Yeah, I think it's very closely in line. You know, look, I think the big moving parts in defense are probably personnel reform and the pivot to Asia and trying to rebalance the procurement to really focus on a new set of technologies to maintain the U.S. Competitive edge there.
Because one of the questions is the size of the Navy when it comes to the Pacific, and this doesn't significantly add ships. I mean, we're not going to have 350 ships or 500 ships
sure.
anytime in the foreseeable horizon. And so how is in the security strategy and in the budget, how is that pivot to Asia that we've heard about for so many years actually going to happen?
Well, so you've heard that 60% of the U.S. military assets will be, especially naval assets, will be in the Asia-Pacific by 2020. So there's the piece about moving the assets and the percentage of assets that you have, number of ships that you have. But then there is also, as you point out, this larger question of keeping the Navy's absolute size at least where it is, but hopefully growing it as well. And there's been, you know, for multiple administrations, you know, going back to the Bush administration, and before, the challenge, given the fact that ships are becoming more technologically sophisticated and more expensive, the challenge of with those more expensive ships being able to buy and sustain enough of them is very much a big one. And I think increasingly defense experts are looking at for a long time quality trumped quality, but I think increasingly looking at quality having a quality all its own, or excuse me, quantity having a quality all its own, will become more of a priority. In other words, we'll probably take some hits or focus less on technologically exquisite platforms and ships and try and buy some more kind of run-of-the-mill, but keep so that we can buy more of them and keep our numbers up.
So in the terms of aircraft, then, that would, say, mitigate in favor of building a whole bunch of F-18s and not so many F-35s.
Yeah, I think there's a desire to kind of diversify the portfolio, right? So buy some F-18s, buy some F-35s, buy some long-range UAVs, and then also invest in the long-range strike bomber. So then having a more diverse set of portfolio of fighters, so that you can the problem with the F-35 is its limited range, and so if basically most of your fighter jets are F-35 and you don't have this sort of mix, the things that you can do with them is therefore limited. And so I think having that more diverse set of fighters is an important goal.
And also, this new strategy addresses the nuclear question once again. And what do you think will come out of all of this in terms of modernization of the nuclear, say, the missiles that are now in the silos and in different other elements of the nuclear force? Because it again talks about a world without nuclear weapons.
Sure.
But is that going to be something that you think the administration will be, in Congress, will be willing to invest in, at least maintaining what exists now? Because
yeah,
some of it's getting pretty old.
Sure. That the goal of a world without nuclear weapons has always been a goal that's reliant on cuts in arsenals that are concurrent with other countries, Russia and China and other places in particular. So that's never been a near-term goal. I think the challenge for the nuclear arsenal, broadly speaking, for the United States is as we try to modernize all three legs of the triad, right? Bombers, submarines, and ICBMs, the modernization costs for each of them, which are mostly coming all at the same time, starting in the early 2020s, is going to overwhelm and crowd out other investments in the Navy's budget and the Air Force budget. You've already seen Navy and Air Force ask for the nuclear pieces to be brought out into a separate nuclear budget, but the money has to come from somewhere. So that's really going to be the challenge. You are getting to a point where all of those platforms need to be modernized, but you can't. It's very hard budget-wise to do them all at the same time, so there's some real tough choices coming up.
And if you look at this version, the 2015 version of the National Security Strategy, and compare it to the 2010 version, what do you see as the major shifts?
I see as a major shift, I think, a bigger focus on geopolitics, right? Russia, countering Russia, Russia's aggression, and Chinese assertiveness. You know, it's not the main focus of the strategy, but if you look at the 2010, it's much more that a pivot from the Obama administration away from, pivot from the Bush administration, which really focused on the war against terror and ground wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. This, the 2015 version, is a pivot from 2010, moving away from, at least to some degree, some of that kind of talking about a broader set of threats and not using military force, to pivoting really more towards this look at geopolitics. It's not mentioned as directly in the China section, but if you look at the defense section and the way it deals with challenges to shared spaces, or what other people have called the global commons, there's some very strong language here about air, space, cyber, maritime challenges, and pushing back on those, within the realm of international rules and norms, but with the U.S. in the lead.
Jacob Stokes is a fellow at the Center for New American Security. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.